So the allocation of resources here involve those who are in the design, development, and construction of facilities, engineers, and all the support. So that if you combine, say, your engineering department, you can handle, with this group of people, a major open construction, and 2 years later, you can have those same people with a major refinery expansion, a big coker or a coal conversion or whatever. And that means not only that you are in a reasonably stable employment situation, but that you are able to recruit people into the system from the universities on a steady basis without the disruptions and ups and downs. And this is a point that I have tried to hammer and hammer. It is critically important in terms of the relationship of the industrial concern to the universities, but it also is critical in terms of people who are involved. When you do this, you cannot, like a major engineering contractor, hire 100 and lay off 100, and expect any sort of performance and loyalty. Sure, they do a job, you know, but this. So, in terms of the preservation of our people's sanity, security is the word I'm seeking, and their ability to perform productively within that, including salary, benefits, promotion, opportunities, etc. That seemed to me to be the way to do it, or seemed to me to be a real plus. Therefore, Olefins I looked at as a big hunk of that sort of thing, as well as the integration of the facilities itself. We tore down the fences between the chemical plant and the refinery in every one of these places. I mean, literally, the physical part. And for the first time in the history of Deer Park out here, as an example, in, I'm going to say like 76, 75, 76, we were able to shut down the facility for maintenance at one end or the other and use craftsmen from the other end to help out the base craftsmen who were already assigned there. We couldn't do that before. Now that took, we had to pound the union on that, of course, but that was a part of literally tearing down the fences. And of course, at the same time, we have a complex manager, and he has a superintendent at each end, if you want to look at it this way, and so forth, but you got a common treasury, and you got a common warehouse, and you got a common transportation set up, and you got a common planning operation. You've got to have your scheduling and planning, it's got to fit both at the same time. So it just made good sense to me, and that took some doing too, I can tell you.
I was going to ask who you had to sell on that. Which leads me to another question, that is, who, as president of Shell Chemical, were you reporting?
I was reporting to the president of Shell.
Okay.
And when I first got the job, this is from headquarters still in New York, a man named Dennis Kimball Cook was the president of Shell. He was an interim man between McCurdy and the time that we moved to Houston. We moved to Houston, and another Britisher by the name of Harry Bridges became president of Shell. He had been president of Shell Canada, another exploration production side guy, and a real prince. And I was lucky enough to hit it off, particularly with him, to where he had sufficient confidence in the kinds of things that I was trying to do and would try to explain, etc. To where I didn't have a free ring, but I had leeway, and that's very important. And I was lucky enough to have that kind of mentality and personality at the top at that time. That changed afterwards, but we won't get into that until later, maybe. But during the major phases of knocking down the fences, reorganization, the putting together of oil products and chemical products, which is, or names that we attach to this, so that I became executive vice president for Shell Oil as well as president of Shell Chemical. That really was just titular. The job was the whole thing, anyhow, both the refining side and the service stations, and all it went on that side as well as the Shell Chemical. I'm waving my arms all over the place, I'm sorry.
No,
I had British support, you know, all this. I think most people could see that intellectually, at least, this made sense. And the real question had to do with the ability to convince people and to make a team out of it that would really operate as a team, etc. Now we go back to the trust and this sort of thing. And as I say, some of them never got on board, but a lot of them did. Yeah.
I can see where there would be reluctance, but at the same time, it could be a lot of fun.
Oh, terrible fun. I mean, just great fun. it really was just, oh, it was just terrific to see these guys grab the reins and start off, you know. And I'd get a call, you know, and, well, Jack, you really would love to be here today. We just tore down the last piece of fence. Or what have you, you know. So it was fun. I wound up with, organizationally then, with six vice presidents. I had a guy who ran all of manufacturing, both sides. I had chemical products vice president and an oil products vice president. Under each of those were product, not divisions, but product line, product groups. In other words, you'd have a plastics man, a polymers man, say, a basic chemicals guy, and he'd have about three guys. He had to use the common ground for all of his support, engineers, finance guys, legal, environmental, health, any of them, all common, and had to use those. So we had a chemical and an oil product. The oil products would be divided, of course, in gasoline, diesel and heating oil fuels, residual fuels, lubricants, asphalt, etc. So that was three. And we had a research, technical research and development and engineering guy. He ran the engineering and he did all of it. The interface with both Shell Development and any other research that we were doing on whatever basis, including that and we contracted for with the group and vice versa. There was always an exchange agreement there. and then we had a man who did the health, safety, and environment. By this time, and incidentally, I had a terrible time even selling that idea, and I'll get to that later. That's the guy that succeeded. Bridges, and then the sixth one was the man who. Who had charge of and basically negotiated the Saudi Arabian venture across 6.5 solid years of negotiation. But he needed the vice president's title, I can tell you. And that's highly successful operation now. It's a 50-50 operation. And people may wonder why why we wanted to do that. And incidentally, that was fought tooth and nail by the Royal Dutch Group. What is Shell Chemical are doing over here? This sort of thing. We've got all our olefins plants, et cetera, in Europe, and they are such and such oriented. And now you're going to put the Saudis in this kind of business, and they're going to be dumping stuff into Europe and whatever. Well, to some degree, maybe they have across the years. But the idea, basically, was that Saudi Arabia is the last place in the world, I think, that's going to run out of oil. And with the lessons that I learned through the early 70s and the embargoes, et cetera, and what happened, both from a governmental standpoint and then all the consequences, some of which is still being litigated, as well as just purely being able to operate a facility for the benefit of the U.S. citizen, you got to have some access to crude oil. We have, as I've said, never been self-sufficient in crude oil. No chance of being on a domestic basis, or nothing in sight elsewhere for that matter. And therefore, with the logic that that's going to be the last place, and the fact that Shell, either at the group level or at the U.S. level, had zilch relationship with Saudi, zero. That it was time to try to get a foot in the door. And so as a consequence of our investment, which was only half of the plant cost, et cetera, we had an agreement for access to Saudi crude ad infinitum. And whether or not that's been used is beside the point. Very, very worthwhile, in my view. In any event, close the loop here. The last vice president there had to deal with that. terribly, terribly complex and frustrating mixed set of negotiations. And at a time when facilities weren't really all that nice to stay in Saudi Arabia.
It leads me to another question I wanted to ask you, and that was how you were there. You came in just before the energy crisis and lived through that, and how what effect that had on your operations.
It was terrible, absolutely terrible. Most frustrating period from a standpoint of really being able to do anything that I ever went through. With all of the Nixon price controls, and then the embargo, and the entitlements programs, and the quotas, etc., we were. And when I said some of them still being litigated, that's still, the definition of old crude and new crude, and the terribly, terrible mess that the government was able to put together there. We were in constant hot water. Hot water, not in the sense of doing anything wrong, but hot water in terms of it was always hot and there was always an argument. And, we had something like 15 government auditors on site, which we had the supply office and telephone and everything else for all the time, every day, day in, day out. And these guys would wander up and down the halls and get somebody to talk about this or that. Just, absolutely ridiculous. And among other frustrations that came through all that, and you have no problem in understanding why I think the government is the worst possible solution. And in fact, I don't think it is a solution. But one of the things that would bug me really most profoundly every month is on this definition of the entitlements and the old and new crude thing. I would wind up signing a check for somewhere between $20 and $28 million each month to who? Texaco. Now, can you imagine? Can you imagine? So, it was hard, and of course, including in all that, of course, were times when people couldn't buy gasoline. Somebody would stick a microphone in front of you, or a TV camera, mm-hmm. or some event. It was a mess. On top of that, we still had the Vietnam War, and there still were the activists, and if you will, the terrorist threats that were going on, and that got personal, also, and because of the title, if nothing else, and it was on the Shell Oil Board or this, that, and the other. This attracted attention. My wife, when we lived here in Houston, but out in the Memorial area, one morning opened the mail, and it was a letter, two big red slashes on it, supposedly blood, threatening to kill her and the kids unless her husband stopped, quote, killing all these people with napalm or with, you know, whatever the hell. This turned out to be squeaky prong.
Yeah, okay.
She dropped the letter, and so they got some prints and this sort of thing. Another time, I was in doing one of these tour around situations. Gene was with me. We had a meeting of the old, which is now the CMA. I think still an MCA at that time. It was out west somewhere, and she was with me. And I had this talk at the Agricultural Chemical Division headquarters in San Ramon, California. And there was nothing secret about me being there of any sort, but that morning somebody blew up with a bomb the transformer station right next to the building. Well, that gets your attention. Another time, I had a speech to make in San Francisco at St. Francis. And there was some kind of little reception in the back of the ballroom ahead of time. And I was standing talking with some people, and all the lights went out. I mean, totally black. And the next thing I knew, somebody grabbed me by the arm. Well, it was a security guy. Thank goodness. But it was quite a prelude to a little speech, I can tell you. Another time we had a shell plane. Again a West Coast to Houston trip that had a flame out on one engine, which was never traced and never really tied down, but it was coincident with some of these other things that I've been talking about. So all that was mixed in with this situation, and it was a pretty tumultuous period. Mm. And we were trying to do things in the company, and we were getting some things done, but
with all of that going on, it's amazing you could keep focused on your overall agenda, which was to do all this reorganization.
Well, the reorganization thing, Jim, is a matter of timing, among other things. But it's and it can be done, and it's been attempted in a lot of different ways. There is a theory that you're in this mode today, and you do everything, throw it up in the air, and everybody lands this way on Monday next week. In my view, that's been unsuccessful. That's not really, you don't convince anybody. And they scramble around for for days and days trying to find out where, what their role is and what have you. A more gradual approach, particularly trying to sell the idea and to convince people of where they're going to be and how this is going to work, etc. And gradually implementing it is a much preferred way, was preferred in my case anyhow. And that being the case, in terms of keeping a focus on a forward agenda, well, things weren't happening every afternoon anyhow. You know, you just, you could find ways to do this. And sure, you wound up working pretty long hours, for sure. But that's, you know, that was all part of the game, too. And so I didn't find that part to be a problem. And in addition, of course, I had excellent help, excellent people. I said to some of the senior people from the group more than one time that these guys, these fellows that were my vice president, just using them as an example, any one of them could run the whole outfit without a hitch. And by the whole outfit, I meant the whole worldwide outfit. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Really, they're that good.
I'm intrigued by how starting out, well, you had the chemical company, but at the plant site, you managed to get the fences down and get your nose into the oil part at the same time. And is that, again, going back to Bridges, is that because he was supportive of that?
He was supportive of that, yeah.
But how did you go about getting on the other side of the fence, as it were?
Well, I just had to remind them that I came through the refineries. I knew what the refineries, what refineries were like. I knew what head office operations on the oil side was like. Mm-hmm. I had the transportation and supplies jobs, etc. This was not all strange to me. I had an understanding of what was going on there. I had been intimately involved in their labor negotiation problems through the years, both on when I was still there on that side of the house as well as other places. And so you know, it wasn't just like somebody from Mars saying, well, let's do it this way. There was an understanding. I had worked in lubes. I understood how some of the lube business ran. Original fill type operations with the big automobile manufacturers. They interfaced with the Caterpillars and the, you know, stuff like that. Asphalt, road paving type situation. Had a plant at Martinez when I was there that made that kind of stuff. So wasn't all strange. More or less accepted. I guess the part that was the toughest for them to accept was that I admitted to them, I didn't know a thing about service station operations, and I still don't. but they were there. Shell's always been a good gasoline marketer, and so I made sure that I had the kind of people there that I thought were good at it. They were largely there anyhow. And then more or less, we had no problem. I had real problem with a guy who was basically running the heating oil business. He had distributors and barge terminals and barges and all this stuff all over various places to service the heating oil market. And of course, that heating oil was great feed for thermal for an Olin's cracker, and I had a real problem with him. but to this day, we're friends. I see him a couple of times a year at one of the Shell luncheon situations, and he says, "Well, I'll never forgive you for taking away." That's all right. You know. feeling I'm being awfully, awfully verbose, but also it sounds very much like bragging. And
No.
I'm sorry about that.
No, not at all. Not at all. Well, let me, I have some other things here, but I am not clear from the records that I have. You became president of Shell Chemical in 67, director of the company at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was this executive vice president of Shell Oil, which you said was titular, but you were still president of Shell Chemical. But I'm not sure what happened after that. I don't have anything in my records.
Well, those were the jobs. I had those jobs when I retired.
Okay. And what year was that then?
79. September 1st, 79.
Okay. So then you were essentially doing that up until that time. All right.
Right. Which then, as it turns out, I had 12 years on the board, 12 years with the Shell Chemical thing, but only the last three or so with this combination.
Some numbers that I pulled out here, this is 76. I think I remember reading somewhere when you took over, sales were $100 million or something like that.
In Shell Chemical?
Shell Chemical. Mm-hmm. And by 76, it was $1.5
billion. Yeah, I got to $3 billion before I left.
Because the article I have from 78 says it was $1.7 billion in 77, and you were predicting $2 in 78, so...
Maybe my numbers are wrong. I think it got close to $3.
Okay. Well, that's quite a testimony to what you've done.
Well, it was. The happy thing about it, those numbers are just sales numbers, but there was a bunch at the bottom line too,
mm-hmm.
and that we all felt pretty proud of.
You got into doing other things like detergents at that time too.
Yes, sir.
And that became a pretty important part of.
That's a big one. That's there's a good example of the support of and the development of fundamental basic research. Totally different approach to building linear paraffins. There's an oligomerization process, starting with ethylene as an example. All fit into that, but done basically by Shell development and research, but with the encouragement and support right along. This is the kind of thing that without that, I'm not sure it would ever come about. And even after we had successfully, in my view, successfully demonstrated the process at, say, the demo level or large pilot scale, there were some real questions about proceeding to commercial. And